Did you know that if you plug your microphone into a different USB port, it like shows up as a different device? Because like Audio Hijack has my little template in there, but since I'm plugged into a different, I'm plugged into the iMac instead of the monitor loop through because it's on the other side now, that it's like, hey, your ATR is not plugged in. And you click the little drop down. It's like, would you like to use this ATR or that ATR? It's like, well, same thing. It's just in a different place.
Well, I mean, I think that's mainly because it's different ports on different devices. If I plug my microphone into different ports on my MacBook Pro, it thinks it's the same thing. But Skype always says, hey, you know what? Let's use the default audio device, which would be the microphone on the laptop. So every time I go to call you or to call Micah or do an incomparable episode, I have to go up to the audio settings and I have to make sure ATR USB is set up before I call, because if I don't do that and I have to do it during the call, then I will have a series of very short recordings from Call Recorder, which will include my a video of me sitting there trying to adjust my microphone settings, because video preview is part of the audio video settings, which means that it gets recorded by Call Recorder, which I know you've seen before because it's so great.
It's fabulous is what it is.
But nobody's really here to talk about these minor audio visual issues. What they want to talk about is the month of Dan Octada, or they want to talk about Raw in October, or they want to talk about...
What are you doing right now? Are you deliberately misleading our listeners?
Yeah, I was just having a little fun. Yeah, so this is not Jean-Pierre Junetober. This is Foxtober. We're going through the catalog of Fox properties, franchises that are going to be consumed by Disney as part of the merger that's coming up. Because, you know, it's October and we do scary stuff every year. And what could be more scary than a brand being eaten by another brand? And all of their stuff being repurposed as part of this new being. Not that there are any similarities to the themes of this film. But
this theme definitely makes sense on multiple levels if you think about it really hard.
There are so many levels. So Foxtober is really lazy, because we needed to do Alien Resurrection, because we've done an Alien movie every October since we started this stupid thing, and that means that this is the fourth one, and that is one of the bad Alien movies, because there are really only two good ones, and there's just a bunch of garbage after that, and it's garbage that's worth talking about, I feel like.
Sure. As people who own a podcast, it's definitely justifiable to talk about this movie.
It's justifiable garbage. It's garbage that you could put as a line item on your taxes. Okay. So Fox is like, hey, we have a franchise, and it is this Aliens thing, and we need to keep making these things, and we don't want to spend, quote unquote, too much money. And we also want to have new, vibrant, crazy ideas. So we'll do them both at the same time. And this resulted in hiring David Fincher to come on, and then just sort of monkeying with him with a bunch of executive producers and studio executives dumping all over everything and making a mess of things and a final product that was five parts set design from a previous director and like three parts stuff that was thrown together in the edit. And then you get this monstrosity, Alien Resurrection, where you're like, surely they learned a lesson, and they didn't. It's just like, so this Jean-Pierre Jeunet guy is pretty hot right now because he did this French movie called The City of Lost Children. And it's like, yes, but he's never directed an American film before.
Is that a movie I should have heard of? The thing you just said?
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty... It's fancy in an artsy, filmy school kind of a way.
I don't think I've even heard of it. Oh, does this have Ron Perlman in it? Oh, look at that.
Yeah, yeah. That's why Ron Perlman is in this.
Mm.
And apparently the Fox execs were not certain about the casting of Ron Perlman. They were suspect about that casting.
Well, you just give him some face scars and let him curse at everybody.
I honestly, Ron Perlman is the least of the casting problems with this film. Well, I mean, I guess Sigourney Weaver's the least, but this is the second least. You get Dominique Pignon, who comes along for the ride.
There's a big gap between the first and second, I think, in that particular issue.
I mean, I'm not graphing these, Dan.
I will graph them for you.
Thank you, because I am a robot and I need them graphed. Dominique Pignon it was on all of Jean-Pierre Jeunet's movies before this, and he's a very famous French actor who doesn't do much, if any, English work, really. I think he's like on the TV show Outlander, which is made by Starz, and has a very international cast. But Dominique Pignon leads us like four French movies a year. Like he's cranking them out. But he's in
he's
every
like the French Nicolas Cage.
No, I think he's a little more together than that. But he's in every Jean-Pierre Jeunet movie. Period. All of them, even to this day. Not that there have been that many, but he's more recognizable for American audiences probably from Amélie, because Amélie, while being a French film, had a huge opening here in the United States for a foreign language film with subtitles. So that is probably his more famous thing than this, ironically.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen Amelie?
Parts of it. I have a framed poster, picture, whatever, that's from that movie, I later found out.
Oh. I like Amelie. It's been a really long time since I've seen it, but I like Amelie, and I feel like Jean-Pierre Jeunet's sensibilities were well-suited for that task. Of course, I phrased it that way because I feel like his sensibilities were not well-suited for this particular task.
No.
And so Fox's desire to have a cut-rate artsy director produces fluctuations, both in David Fincher and in this, with
it's
John
like somebody
Pierre
walked into a Universal Studios ride with a camera on their shoulder and just like found a bunch of shots.
But they're all 14 millimeter shot from basically the ground, and they all have a ring light.
Yeah, so they're either on the ground looking at feet, they're 2 inches away from somebody's face with a ring light in it, or they're just well, I guess even the extreme wides to show the set are still on the ground.
So there's some stuff in here that's interesting because you hired an artsy director, but there's a lot of stuff in here that doesn't work because you hired an artsy director who might be doing artsy stuff at the expense of things that would make more sense, or be more pragmatic or functional. And then you have Fox executives coming in and mucking it up along the way. You have a script by Joss Whedon, who was a well-known script doctor at the time. He had his successful series Buffy the Vampire Slayer running after his unsuccessful movie Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Neither of which I watched, so whatever.
Yeah. Well, people who would see his later works might recognize some of Joss Whedon's sensibilities in the dialogue, as well as in the fact that there is a scrappy crew of people who are not following the law, but are supposed to be people we like, but they kidnapped frozen human popsicles for military experiments. So, yay?
No, they were stupid. Yeah.
You ever seen Firefly, Serenity, that whole thing?
I think I watched one, maybe two Fireflies.
I watched the whole series because Casey Liss kept harping about how great it is, and I disagree.
There's space, but there's also horses.
Oh, God. The horses are, like, the biggest stumbling block, to be perfectly honest. It's one of those things where it's like, I want to have a Wild West show, and everybody's going to be all Wild Westy, but space. And it's like, but it doesn't, these aren't going together. Mm-hmm. One great taste and one awful taste that don't go well together, despite what Reese's Peanut Butter stuff might tell you. Yeah, not great. And so there's a little proto Firefly here, where you have a crew of jerkwads who are going to collect their big payday off of doing something illegal, but are involved in situations that are bad, that are, you know, far above them. So they have to get out of that. And then you have...
But it's also kind of an Alien 2 thing, right? Where you got your crew of people who fight and do stuff and know each other, and they come in and they work together with Ripley, theoretically, to do a thing. But I don't like any of the people in this movie, really.
I like Cole, Winona Ryder's character.
Sure.
She's kind of, she's naive, but you can kind of forgive her for her naivete because she's, how should I say this? She's an android. Spoiler alert if you haven't seen this movie.
She's a robot.
Yes.
This is, they've also taken the alien future and fast forwarded it 200 years or something so that, androids are no longer a thing because they, were bad and then they had to cancel them or something.
There was a government recall.
Right, like, sure, but some of them survived.
Like bad romaine lettuce. it doesn't make any sense either because Winona Ryder says that the reason why she's doing this mission is because she accessed the mainframe, whatever that is, before she was involved in the government recall so that she would know that this ship had the was coming in with these people for this government experiment and that Ripley was involved. She knew all of that from that time period, which means it couldn't have been that long ago that the recall happened. But the way that CSI What's-His-Face says it, it's like it happened like before he was born, at least with all of the deck stomping, etc. It is weird. The timeline is strange. Also, Weyland-Yutani Corporation has been gone for so long that it is but a distant memory that Brad Dourif needs explained to him by the other doctor, Dr. Jerkface Wren. And it kind of introduces like an unnecessary complicated wrinkle to this. It's like, is there anything about this vessel that seems particularly military? And so it could have just been the company. It's just like you just want to make it sound like it's further in the future by making it the military.
Given that it's massive and understaffed and people can just walk around punching in codes into doors and get where they need to go, no, it doesn't seem particularly military to me. But
also how rusted out it is.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess maybe that's part of the alien future thing that they want to build on, and that's okay if you want to go that way, that, like, you know, space travel's been such a thing for so long and there are so many, you know, things just floating around that people take them over and use them as necessary rather than rebuild new stuff, whatever. That's a thing you can build on. But so many of the questions in this movie, just while you can understand like how literally the mechanics of how Winona Ryder's character as an android could have accessed a mainframe and got this particular information, none of those questions stand up to a single why. Like, why did she access any particular military database before she had to escape? Why is she on this mission to kill this alien that is, in her mind, so bad that it could wipe out the human race or something? But, like, why is that her duty? Why is she taking it upon herself to not tell anyone, to sort of, I don't know, find herself in this position where she can sneak aboard the ship under the guise of working with these other people to help, like, kill Sigourney Weaver to stop the alien? Like, none of it makes any sense if you ask just a single, why are you doing that? To basically any character, which is the problem with everything that happens in this movie. None of it makes any sense. Like, you can see the mechanics of, like, sure, the alien escaped, and they got to run away, and for some reason, the queen alien that they took out of Ripley has a nest that is between them and the airlock, although I don't know why they didn't keep the queen in some sort of, like, locked room, even though they were keeping all of the actual xenomorphs in locked up rooms, even though they escaped. But the queen is over there making her own thing, just because apparently that's the iconic imagery from Aliens that they wanted to recreate. But why is it over there? I don't know. It doesn't matter. We got to go past them, and then there's going to be a thing that they're going to have to confront because she falls to the floor. But, like, oh God.
Okay, we should start at the beginning.
Yeah, there's a lot of things to talk about that are stupid.
It just gets confusing if we just start picking it apart by various
bits. Okay, so I have a couple of framing questions for you. Yeah. So, like, in terms of characters in this movie, we've sort of talked about, we've got a ragtag group of people on the Betty or whatever. We got Sigourney Weaver clone. We got jerkbag military science guys. Who's our main character that we're supposed to care about and follow along with? Ostensibly, it would be Ripley, right? Like, that's kind of what she's in these movies for, isn't it?
Yes. Ripley and Cole are the two that we're supposed to follow.
Okay, but the problem I have with that, and let me know if you had the same problem, is that she's a clone who also has superpowers because she's got mixed in alien DNA somehow. But, like, she's got, like, the mental capacity of an 8-year-old for the first, well, like, half of the first act because she evolves very quickly or something. But she's not the same person. Like, personality-wise, she's not the same person. She doesn't have the same goals as the Ripley that we have come to know and love. Like, she's not John McClane in space trying to, like, just save herself and kill the alien and escape. She's, I don't know, being sassy and running around playing basketball, and then she feels sad when the baby gets killed. So, like, I don't know how we're supposed to care about what happens to her. Also, she kind of seems indestructible to a certain degree because she's, like, you know, super powerful or whatnot because she's got alien blood.
Yeah, but that doesn't have anything to do with whether or not she's the protagonist.
Right, I know, but, like, why are we rooting for her? What does she want, and why do we care if she gets it or not?
She's Ripley, and that's why we care. I'm not saying that because I agree with that. I'm saying that's the way this is written.
Yeah.
She's Ripley. The audience knows she's Ripley, and that's why we care. And that's why she's in the film. That's why she needs to survive through the process of this film. Mm. And that explains that part of it. Now,
right, but didn't you find it odd that she's Ripley, but she's not acting like Ripley for the first part of the movie? Didn't that kind of, like, sour that for you for a little bit?
Well, of course it does, and that's why this is not a well-reviewed film that people love. It's not done well because they wanted to have it a different way. They wanted to have it this other dimension because Ripley is a clone because she did not survive the events of Alien 3. As we have established, she fell backwards into a rear screen projection of her death or whatever it was.
Lava.
She died in molten metal town. Apparently there was a blood sample. They say this in dialogue, really quickly, which lets you know that they had full faith, in the idea that she was recovered from a blood sample from Fury, whatever it was called, the penal fire molten planet. They have that blood sample. They used that blood sample to create a reproduction of her with the purpose of reconstructing the alien embryo so that they would have a viable queen that they could use to birth aliens. This raises many questions on all just not just like science, but like if you just even do like SAT logic on this, it raises a lot of questions.
None of it works.
No, that's why they just sort of like quickly say it and then just get moving, because if they dwell on explaining it, it makes less sense. And if they try to you know, diagram it out for us in a very explicit, very detailed way about how this functions, that it would have been bad movie making too. So they just blurt it out and then they just get going because they figure that it'll be so interesting that we will forgive them for whatever this setup was, this inconvenient setup was. The problem with that, of course, is that people generally are not going to overlook the fact that she has been recreated with some crossover between her and the aliens to a certain extent, and that causes a different form of acting to occur for Ripley. different abilities, as you pointed out, and different characteristics, but also just like just the general acting, where Sigourney Weaver is pacing around a set like a Komodo dragon, and then will like rub her hands all over someone's face. So it is not a Ripley that you're accustomed to, and I can understand why from Sigourney Weaver's point of view, it may have been more interesting for her to tackle this role from another perspective. Having said that, a more experienced director might have reined her in and said, please don't do that. You look like a crazy person. And nobody wants to watch Ripley sort of semi-sexually rub on Winona Ryder for a little bit. For a lot of it, really. But it is one of the weirder things that is introduced by this concept that there's this genetic crossover that occurs. And then you also have the fact that you can somehow create an alien embryo that is fully functional from
it's
a
like
blood
version
sample.
Of cloning restores her in place like they did a super duper backup of her. Like you restore her to the same state she was in when she died, which was having an alien in her chest that they surgically remove and keep her alive.
Yeah, because even if you had the DNA, it's not like the Ripley's DNA was not programmed so that there was an alien parasite inside of her chest. That is not how that DNA would have worked. It would not have like regrown an alien in the middle of her chest.
Yeah. Now the only thing I was thinking is like the blood sample is a mix of her blood and the alien's blood because they were both in there at the same time, and it's like a two variable equation where like they don't know how much of X and how much of Y, so they just start like mixing things back and forth until they're like, oh, this one kind of looks like Ripley now, but we added a little bit extra too much alien to the equation, so now she's got a little bit extra features that are, you know, she's got some acid blood which comes and goes as the plot needs it. But she's also good at basketball.
Yeah, well, but that's what makes it so frustrating is because that doesn't make any sense because they do indeed want you to have it read like she's restored in place like she was from this other film, except that they just mixed from column A and from column B. But that, genetically, that does not make any sense because...
No, also she has some memories, but not all memories. Like, she doesn't have any alien memories.
Yeah.
How cool would it be if she had, like, memories of the alien home planet?
Well, let's not go there. It's out of the scope for this discussion. We'll cross that Covenant Road when we have to. Covenant Road. Take me home, Covenant Road. No. Don't take me home there. That would be awful.
I don't know if this podcast is going to make it. What? How many do we have to do? Like six years total for that?
Ugh. Man.
It depends on if we're counting AVPs. Then we got to get, what, 8 years in before we get to Covenant?
I don't know. Take your vitamins, Dan. But this is an endurance test. Because at this point, they just want to have these chess pieces on the chessboard. They want to have Ripley, and they want to have the aliens. And to get the aliens, they want to have the alien queen, because that gets you more aliens, as they established in the second film. So they want to have...
Oh, right, because she fights the queen in the end of Aliens, and is that the one that we assume got on the ship and got in her for Alien 3?
Really delicate way of putting that. But yes... in the opening credits of Alien 3, there are eggs inside of the escape pod that is jettisoned. Eggs inside the Sulaco, which hatch and then breach the cryotubes, which causes...
There were eggs inside the cubes of lamb?
No.
Did you say souvlaki?
I said Sulaco.
Oh, right. Okay, never mind.
The ship.
The ship. The ship made of lamb.
No, not the skewers. The aliens needed a hero, so they sought out Sigourney Weaver and Hicks and Newt, and they tried to get in there at them. And then their cryotubes were ejected by the Sulaco and landed on that horrible mining planet, and that all happened in the opening credits of Alien 3. which is left a bad taste in everyone's mouth because it was a credit sequence that contained child murder. That's what you had. It bothered a lot of people, I think, because Newt and Hicks were characters, and then they were...
I liked Hicks. Hicks was good.
Okay, well, they died in the opening credits, but there was the alien that made itself and made its way into Ripley's esophagus or whatever, and she scans it later using the medical scanner that's on board the escape pod and determines that it was a queen, that it is a queen. But they need to kill the other alien that made it to the planet before it kills everybody else and stuff. So they do that, and then...
Now that you're saying that, she didn't need to do any of that. All she had to do was kill herself, because without the queen, they can't lay any more eggs.
But Dan... It doesn't make any sense.
No.
No.
I didn't think queens laid... Queens.
No. Well, I mean, well, of course they do. Where do you think queen bees come from, Dan?
What are the odds that the queen laid the queen specifically in Sigourney?
Well, that's just poetic. She may have sensed her life was in danger and deposited, ovoposited, a queen there.
From the book Ovipository?
Yes.
Sorry. I'm laughing at literally the dumbest thing I could have possibly said.
Well, it's an ovipositor. It's a very technical term, Dan. But yeah. So that explains...
It was really the mafia the whole time. It was actually a cover-up.
But that's why she plunges into the fire and stuff and kills herself, is because she knows that she has a queen that is going to burst out of her chest, and indeed it does as she is falling to her death. And that is why she is sought after, and why the one that they cut out of her in the opening sequence of this film is a queen. And
because they restored her in place.
Yes, which doesn't, like we said, makes no sense. But
also, how did they know that? Was it, I guess, like everything is recorded or something, right? So they would have had some sort of Nest Cam recording saying from Alien 3 saying, oh no, look, it's Queen. And then after she burned herself, they're like, well, we still really want these aliens. What are our options? Let's review the tapes.
Yeah. Also, you had the conversation with Bishop and, well, not Bishop, but the guy who designed Bishop, apparently. And you had the distress call, etc., and stuff sent by the warden before he died, with details and stuff. So they knew that there were aliens there. That's why they sent people there to collect the aliens at the end of the film. So it wasn't a mystery, but the part where they could restore her in place, as you said, is the difficult part. And so 200 years later, they had science, air quotes, to create a clone of Ripley that had this alien inside of her and would also, by this process, the alien embryo had apparently transcribed Ripley's memories as part of the infestation, and had recorded that in such a way that when the alien embryo was brought back to life, that it would rewrite her synapses so that they would be the same as they were before. Which
medical science has gotten really, really cool in the future.
I suppose it is a bunch of BS. But even if you just say, okay, fine, movie, I will buy this ridiculous premise to move on from this to get to the good part, then you're still going to be sorely disappointed by everything else that happens afterwards, because you get this weird Sigourney Weaver who's not Sigourney Weaver, because she's not... You get this weird Ellen Ripley who's not Ellen Ripley. That's the way to phrase that. Because she is, of course, Sigourney Weaver the entire time. But...
Are you sure?
Yes.
There's a part in this movie where there's two of them at the same time, so which one was the real one?
Well, there was a body double that was used. Yeah, the naked casting that you see at the beginning and that horrible opening scene, the floating cross-armed adult version was Sigourney Weaver's face, but the body part was somebody else.
Okay.
Yeah. Also, I should just get this out of the way. I don't like the opening because we have this horrible title sequence that's just a bunch of elastic image morphs of the grotesqueries that are inside of the clone room from later. And then you have space, which it should have just started with, and then the dumb ship. And then inside the dumb ship, we have a camera from some omniscient point of view opening doors, which I don't like because... there's nothing that motivates this stuff that's happening. You just get a camera moving till a door opens and it moves through that door to the next area and no one is going through the door. It's not a character moving. It is
maybe
you
it's just
as the
a
audience.
Gust of smelly wind that opened the door.
Yes. It's exactly what it was. But then you have that horrible morph dissolve from the childlike sculpt of the naked Sigourney Weaver with her arms crossed to the adult sculpt of Sigourney Weaver with her arms crossed. And then they do the surgery scene with Brad Dourif and what's-his-face, who plays Ren. And Brad Dourif is very recognizable for me because he's one of those character actors that whenever you see him, you go, oh, it's Brad Dourif.
He's so creepy. I think he's on a handful of Law & Order SVUs where he is very creepy.
He's always cast as a creepy guy. And I can't imagine why. He was, of course, the evil Harkonnen Mentat in the Dune movie by David Lynch. He's
I definitely remember that.
Yes, because you love that movie. And he played a telepathic homicidal murderer on Voyager, and he's done a bunch of weird stuff. He's the voice of Chucky. I learned today. I did not know that.
The Exorcist 3.
Yeah, he's a creepy weirdo, and he's always cast as a creepy weirdo. He's like, I don't know, if Bruce Stern was weirder. Like, that's Brad Dourif. And
he's a good description.
Yeah, and so he's there. So, you know, like, he's not someone that you were meant to like or to appreciate very much.
Was he on Fringe? I feel like he was on, yeah, he was on Fringe.
I mean,
only
why
one
not?
Episode? Did you watch Fringe, by the way?
I've seen some of Fringe.
Oh, I was locked into that for the first, like, two seasons, and then when you realized that they didn't know what they were doing, it was like, oh, this is going to be bad, so I stopped. Yeah. I don't know how it ended.
Yeah, I stopped with, it was like, we have a hallway that takes you between two universes, and I was like, okay, great.
No, that was a different one. That was a different show.
No, that's Fringe.
The one with the hallway? That was, that's a show that's on, like, now.
No, In the what was it, the third season opening, they established a more permanent connection to the other universe.
Oh
yeah,
was there a literal hallway?
Yeah.
Oh well, they did that in God, what is the show? I can't even think of who the actor is.
Yeah, they basically did it like airlocks or whatever that would take you from one universe to the other. It was dumb.
Kind of like a gate that transports you through the stars to an alternate universe.
Hey. Stargate SG-1 was cool. So
SG-1 was cool or the movie was cool?
Well, both. But SG-1 had Richard Dean Anderson in it.
Yeah, and Richard Dean Anderson is
Richard
is
Dean
cool?
Anderson is the coolest. But
Joe's inner 14-year-old is coming out right now.
Yeah, we should just move on with this disaster before we get into something like Stargate.
Did you ever try to get a MacGyver like feathered haircut?
No, God no. It was an awful mullet. His haircut was bad. So we've opened on this movie. They decided to keep Ripley alive because, well, sure. Dan Hedaya is introduced
because
here.
She didn't die. Basically, they're like, oh, this one's kind of stable.
Yeah, yeah. We should just keep her alive and see what happened. You know, how haven't we accidentally killed this person so far? But they have Dan Hedaya who's like, yeah, no, let's not have her alive. And then they're like, well, but what if we did? And then he's like, okay, fine. But if she does one bad thing, then she's gone because she's a meat byproduct. And our real mission is reveal of alien queen head. And I have to say, this movie has a lot of problems, but there are a couple of things that they do well. Like when Dan Hedaya walks up to that glass wall and then they have the alien queen head start in there, and then it just like slowly cranes the camera as her like mantle of a head moves around. You can see the whole alien queen head puppet part, and it's just like, wow, that's
ominous. I forgot about that shot. So the queen was in captivity in the beginning of the movie. So we assume that she escaped to larger quarters later so she could have her baby in peace?
Yeah, presumably. Or that the section where Ripley falls is the larger quarters section. Because Medlab seemed to be near where the Betty was, because they just took the prisoners across the little ramp thing over there, and then they went behind a door. So
it looked pretty ad hoc, especially when they had Brad Dourif hanging up in the rafters there narrating what the queen was doing.
Everything was covered in alien slime. It was a little...
Yeah.
The geography of that room was not great. But so we established that there's an alien queen, and they have it, and Dan Hedaya is like super interested in that. And there's a cargo coming, and the cargo is on the Betty. An unregistered ship. Sure, fine, whatever. And then they're approaching, and then you get quite possibly the worst casting in the entire film. What's his face? Wilcott?
Michael Wincott?
Yes. Ugh. So bad.
You're not a fan of Michael Wincott, huh?
No. His voice is made of ashtrays. I don't love that.
I think it's a cool sound of voice for Space Cowboy Guy.
No, it's awful. It's really grating. And like, I hear somebody talk like that, and I'm just like, ooh, can you die like in this film really fast so I don't have to hear you again?
Wasn't he in like a Robin Hood style movie or something? Oh, The Three Musketeers. There he is. Boom, 1993. This is the one with, Charlie Sheen, Kiefer Sutherland, Chris O'Donnell, Oliver Platt, and Tim Curry. Why did I see this movie? Why do I remember it? But he plays a bad guy.
Unsurprising. He tries to play like some, I don't know. He tries to do like a little Han Solo, but like also gross. I have captured human beings for sale kind of guy. Like I don't know. Like I don't find anything about him appealing. I don't want
him. He's like vaguely mysterious with a whiff of foreigner.
Yeah, but he talks weird. He has like a weird like kind of, you're not gonna like, you know, play poverty on me now, are you? And blah 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 blah. And it's just like, who talks like that? And I know it's 200 years in the future, but it feels like nobody talks like that ever on any continent or planet or spaceship.
He's kind of from a country of his own.
Yes. Yeah, he proto Firefly. Oh.
He was also in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. So, all right, that's where I'm remembering him from.
Mm-hmm. Did he sound like 7 packs a day in that?
Yeah, totally. Here's a picture of Kevin Costner holding a sword up to his neck.
Okay. Great.
Kevin Costner was Robin Hood.
Yeah, I know that.
Which is about as believable as Winona Ryder being from anywhere other than Southern California.
Well, you know what? I like Robin Hood Men in Tights.
Oh, Men in Tights is good.
Yeah. Yeah, Cary Elwes. I believe him as Robin Hood.
Mm-hmm.
So,
speaking of humorous actors, I'm not certain that Dan Hedaya should be allowed to do serious movies.
No. Here's the thing. It's like, sometimes you see a comedy actor do a serious role and you're like, oh, wow, you have range. People have underestimated you. You can do so many things. And then other times you see a comedy actor do a serious role and you're like, oh, no, stop it. What are you doing?
Please don't do that. Why are you here?
Yeah. So when Michael Wincott and Dan Hedaya are like, you know, trading drinks and dollar bills over the table, it's just like, this is bad. This is a bad scene. Like, we have you know, Ashtray Breath and Dan Hedaya yucking it up across the table from one another. And it's just like, this is who was satisfied with that? I don't understand the pairing. It doesn't make any sense.
They're old pals. Yeah, this movie feels like they took a conceit or a world or a universe and they put a little twist on it and then they twisted it back. But like, you know, once you've already twisted it away, like it loses its structural integrity. So it's not quite lined up properly. And they're like, yeah, we've got this weird sort of mix of like humorous weirdos and creepy guy with a deep voice. And then all of these other strange actors who, you know, Brad Dourif has creepy eyes and stares and does stuff. And then you've got Ron Perlman being the loud guy at the party, but also not terribly threatening. And then Winona Ryder is there. And also, don't forget Sigourney Weaver is still here.
Yeah, because the crew runs into her when she's playing basketball. And Ron Perlman, after taking a break from his I'm a monkey, let me throw a knife scene, is trying to hit on Ripley, and Ripley is sort of quasi teasing him along because she knows she's going to kick his ass. And so she does. She bounces the basketball into his junk. If only he had a haptic codpiece to protect him, but he's troubled by that. And then everybody gets engaged in some fisticuffs until the doctor guy and guards and stuff, and then it's like, you know, don't do the things and stuff, and what are you, blah blah blah. And this is the first time we see her blood that drops on the floor, and then it starts to dissolve the floor, and we're like, oh no, that's what the alien blood does.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is the one instance in the movie where the low camera angle works too, because it really makes you see this Sigourney Weaver is incredibly tall and intimidating.
Yeah, she dunked.
No, that was because they made the basketball hoop like 5 feet off the ground.
Yeah, but she did dunk.
Sure, yeah. But when she's face to face with Ron Perlman, it's just it actually does look intimidating, and it looks good. But all of the dribbling, mm-hmm, she's not well versed in basketball.
No, but I mean she's. You know, this is one of those classic things that studios used to do in the 90s, where one studio would make something and then another studio would make something very similar to try and one-up them and get the cred as being that thing. Remember Deep Impact and Armageddon? You remember, you know, Volcano and Dante's Peak, that stuff. Well, here you have Space Jam and Alien Resurrection trying to vie for the space basketball championship. Like, who does space basketball better? Sigourney Weaver is the Michael Jordan of this movie. She was out of the game, and then they brought her back in.
Space Jam 1996, Alien Resurrection 1997. I would not have called that, but I'm going to say judge's ruling, Joe is correct.
It's the best kind of correct.
Maybe this movie exists in the Space Jam cinematic universe such that this is a training room where this ship would fly all the way around the universe, finding the aliens to play on the monster squad team there, and this is where they would have their tryouts before they would be allowed to go back to Earth and play against Michael Jordan.
Well, I think this is 200 years in the future, and the alien monster squad is no more, so they need to clone the hosts of the alien monster squad and then cut them out of there. But then they still have basketball players who have the capabilities imparted to them by the aliens.
Oh, does that explain why Michael Jordan did that one thing in the movie where his arm stretched real far?
Yes, that is okay. That is the explanation. Because
it's a better side effect than Michael Jordan having acid blood, because that would just be difficult.
Yeah, incredibly difficult. Could you imagine if you had a paper cut? It'd be so inconvenient.
Yeah, you would just ruin the parquet floor in any basketball stadium you were in.
Yeah. I mean, you try to put a Band-Aid on it, you get to the Band-Aid. What do you do? How do you fix that?
That is a good question.
They never talk about blood clotting with the aliens. Because they don't just keep bleeding forever. So, like, what gives?
Maybe it's one of those things where it's like, what is it where you make the volcano with the vinegar and the baking soda?
Yeah.
Maybe it's like the once you have the reaction where the acid hits the air and it becomes volatile, once it's out in the air for a little while, it becomes neutral again.
Oh, maybe like parts of their skin have like some baking soda stuff in them or...
Mm. Yeah, it activates it. Mm-hmm. Like yeast, and then once it has bloomed, it is no longer, because they walk around touching all the goop all over the grates to go like, oh no, look, an alien's here because there's goop.
They don't get
burned.
I like how you went from baking powder to baking soda to yeast, just by virtue of baking.
It's all the same.
No, I mean,
I'm just trying to think of powders that activate liquids.
I think yeast produces acid.
So you're saying their skin has yeast in it?
No, I didn't say that at all. But we're not seeing the big picture here. We should move along because they have the basketball thing and like, what are you? Blah 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 and stuff. And then they go get drunk. And Winona Ryder pretends to be fake drunk with the boxing gloves and then spills her booze and goes outside.
Where did the boxing gloves come from? Are those just hanging out in the military ship there?
Well, there was like a punching bag in the background, so presumably they're in some sort of a rec room.
Of course there was.
But they were in a rec room watching like armored mercenary QVC. Like,
yeah, it's QVC for ancient 19th century pistols.
Yeah, it was very strange. But like apparently that's a good way to spend time. Question that.
It's a good thing they get cable on the spaceship. Yeah. Or do you think they're watching old DVDs? Do you think Dana Day just pops in his favorite retro DVDs of QVC just to remind him of home?
You call up that phone number and it's just Dana Day. Hello.
He's got his own answering service on the other end of the ship to help him feel like he's more at home.
Yeah, I mean, he's used to waking up in the middle of the night, with shoulders and all, to take phone calls.
He's probably gonna keep the temperature pretty cool on that whole ship because he's always wearing a shirt.
But Winona Ryder gets out of there because she has her plan and that she's going to go break into Ripley's room, and she's got a keychain full of what was the name of the popular aerosolized breath spray things from the 90s? Remember those?
Oh, Banaka?
Yes.
The one that in Dumb and Dumber that he puts in his mouth and sprays out.
Yes, she's got a key ring full of Banaka, and so she goes over and opens up the door by using the stupid breath lock thing, which is apparently an idea of Jean-Pierre Jeunet that he took credit for. So
all the other writers are like, you could totally have that one.
Joss Whedon's like, keep it. Have it, it's yours. So she uses that complicated key ring to get an impersonation of Perez so that she can get into Ripley's room, and her plan is to use a knife to kill Ripley, and she wants to confirm that Ripley has the alien first. She sees that there's a scar on the chest, which means the alien may have been removed already, and sure enough, Ripley was just watching her the entire time and would have intervened earlier, but she intervenes now and says, yeah, they took it out of me and she's growing and stuff and you're all gonna die. And then this is like one of those weird artsy, like, I'm a Komodo dragon scenes where,
well, also don't forget she has a telepathic connection to the alien somehow.
Yeah, I couldn't figure out if they meant it to be telepathic or if they wanted it to be like some sort of like pheromone thing or something, because she's always like sniffing at people to determine.
But she's
stuff.
Like, I can feel it behind my eyes or whatever, and I don't know.
Well, she's saying that about she feels like the alien isn't all the way out of her is what the line is. She can feel it behind her eyes. So I don't think it's unclear whether she means she has a telepathic connection directly to these aliens because she is surprised by their presence several times through the film, or whether or not it is somehow scent-based or some other olfactory, you know, whatever thing happening, because she doesn't seem to know their movements exactly. So she doesn't seem to have, like, a connection. But
by the way, I was just looking through some of these photos, and I see Winona Ryder with her ring light in her eyes. And this is even a cheap ring light. It's not even a real ring light. It's just six lights staged in a circle. Like, they don't have, like, a solid circular ring light.
Well,
and yet it's in every single shot.
But I don't think they had the LED solid circles back then, did they? Yeah.
No, but they could have, like, rigged something that was, like, a gel the shape of a circle so that, like, diffused properly. It's just, like, six-point lights.
Yeah, I have to say that it's one of the things that really just takes me out of the most, like, poignant emotional moments of this film, besides the fact that what they're saying is ridiculous, is, like, you're just staring at her eyes or at Ripley's eyes, and their eyes are just got the little broken ring of white light all the time in them, because they're always lit by ring lights in close up, which is incredibly bizarre because there's so much other lighting around them that a ring light is so distinct in the pupil that I don't know why you would want to do that on purpose. Because
I don't know either.
It's very distracting. It's like you could literally use any other light and then it would be a point of light and then we wouldn't be bothered by this because it could be any light source in this room. But when you make it a ring light, it's like, well, when we cut back to the other camera angle, where is the circle of light in here? Is it anywhere? Yeah. I don't see it.
It's also opportunistic, too. Like, it was not motivated at all. There's the one scene where when she goes to, and discovers the 1 through 7s. Did you see the jump cut in the ring light there where we're in the close-up and she's got the ring light in her eyes, and then they cut to a slightly wider angle where you're looking through the window at her, where they obviously couldn't set up the ring light because we're looking at her through a window,
yeah,
and the ring light is gone. But basically, yeah, you're looking at her face and then cut to looking at her face and the ring light's gone. Hooray.
Yeah, they do that several times. Basically, if you can see her torso, like a medium shot, they don't have a ring light. But then you move in any closer than that and they cut to a ring light, which is weird. I don't understand it. Maybe they're like, oh, if we do some soft beauty lighting on Sigourney Weaver, it will, you know, make her look like she is more like she was in Alien 3 for the purposes of age, etc. But I don't feel like that does anyone any favors, because I feel like it's just really distracting and artificial. But it is kind of miraculous how little Sigourney Weaver appears to have aged over the years. Kudos to her for whatever diet regimen she's doing.
So what you're saying is Alien 5 is back on the table.
No, this is not what I said. but there's this whole thing where she does like the fake out of, I'm going to like kill you and take you out of this pain. And then she's like, but what if I don't want to die? What if I can put you out of your pain? And she's like, oh no, leave now before I like murder you by accident or something. And it's like, okay. This is not Ripley. This is something else, because this doesn't seem Ripley-esque at all, except for the part where she doesn't want to murder her. But when a writer turns and walks out and immediately is confronted by Dr. Wren, who is somehow part of the security patrol, and they haul her back to the mess hall where they confront the rest of the crew about the fact that they brought a terrorist and they're going to like kill them all because of that. Which is maybe not the brightest thing to do, since no one did a thorough security sweep of them when they were brought on board. Because they're like, hey, you have a thermos, that's fine. And hey, you have a wheelchair made entirely out of metal, that's also fine. And hey, you have arms that have metal attachments for armatures and guns that we somehow didn't scan at all.
Yeah, even the TSA knows that when you put your hands up and they scan your body, you still have to scan the arms because you could be hiding stuff in there.
Yeah. Take your jacket off. But he, anyway.
Yeah, you can't walk through the scanner with a jacket on.
Yeah. So Wincott's like, hey, go murder those guys. And so he like ricochets bullets off the ceiling and kills people. And, you know, we get the thermos gun and all the other stuff. Everybody's murdered, but Wren is alive, and one of the other guys, or whatever. It's sort of unclear, because right now is also the time when the aliens escape, because Brad Dourif had been playing push the cryo freezy mist button, and, you know, that had not gone over well, because Apparently, they refused his advances when he was smooching on the window. So now they learned the lesson, and they want to go push the button themselves. And so they come up with this convoluted situation where they're going to murder one of their own so that the acid blood of the murdered one will break through the floor, and then they'll be able to escape. That works, because these people are like, acid blood? Why would that matter? It's not like they'd kill one of their own, and they did.
Everyone was in separate cages up until this point. Like, if they were all still in separate cages, you'd be fine.
Well, it does raise an interesting question about the grouping, because they had multiple cages, and there are 12 of them. It's like, why couldn't you put one in each cage? I suppose they might have said, oh, let's study their social interactions or something like that. Mm. There wasn't a line of dialogue that said that. So instead, we're just left to question the wisdom of putting three of them in the cell together. Also, the wisdom of what is your security measure should they breach this? Because the security measure seems to be open the door and walk in to go look and see whether or not they're on the other side of the hole.
Yeah, I mean, you know, although everywhere in the ship is sort of leaking misty gas, so maybe they were a bunch of liquid nitrogen sprayers all over the place.
Yes, perhaps, Dan, or perhaps...
They were just going to freeze the whole ship.
Yes, Brad Dourif sticks his head over and then gets grabbed and pulled through, and then the security guard wanders in, and then he gets frozen by one of the aliens and gruesomely breaks apart T-1000 style, only he's made of flesh and blood, and he's super murdered and dead. So the aliens have the run of the ship now, and Father's all like, hey, evacuate and stuff, with all the urgency that you would expect. And
non-human life form discovered on whatever thing.
I mean, it's kind of an interesting and effective way of saying stuff. It's just that at the same time, you're like, can you lock a door, Father, or something? Maybe, kind of. Like, I don't know. It's weird, because it's like, it like requires a human being to invoke the lock command. They're running around through the ship, and everybody's freaking out and getting off, and Dan Hedaya is freaking out, and everybody's boarding the escape pods, and he's trying to get the escape pods out of there. We see a couple of them go out, and then there's the last one, and the last person runs on there in their gym fatigues, because who knows what they were doing. And an alien leaps from his viewing point onto the escape pod and into it, in a horrible CG alien shot, and then crawls through the interior, basically ripping them limb from limb. Dan Hedaya notices this, and then there's the worst shot of a CG grenade rolling on the ground. The camera is following the grenade as it bounces on the ground into the open hole on the escape pod as the door is closing, so that it's like a shuffleboard game. Or, I'm sorry, not
mini golf?
Yeah. It's just like, this is ridiculous. What are you doing?
I hit the ball through the clown's mouth.
Like, this is... That was, like, done for comedy. It's not... That's not the appropriate tone for this moment.
You think that was a Joss Whedon thing?
No, I don't think that was a Joss Whedon thing. Because we cut back to Dan Hedaya, and he's saluting the brave soldiers who just got exploded by him exploding them. Then behind him, an alien punches through the back of his skull, and he reaches up, sticks his hand into his brain, and pulls out part of his brain, and then goes, oh, look, my brain. And that's the end of Dan Hedaya in this film.
Mm-hmm.
Goodbye. Goodbye, Dan. It's just a little too funny slapstick. Not enough, like...
Terror.
Oh, crap. Yeah. But this evacuates almost all of the crew.
It's like they recognized that this was not scary, and they tried to compensate by making everyone extra shiny, like all the aliens.
Yeah, well, this movie is more about, like, I would say, weird grotesqueness than it is about, like, absolute horror. Like, we get a couple, yeah, like, cheap jump scares, and there are a couple of their tense moments of, like, oh no, the alien has jumped inside the escape pod. That is a tense moment. It's just, it's diffused by, here's a ridiculous grenade-throwing scene, or let's watch the xenomorph swim like iguanas. Like, there's just, like, a silliness to it, where it's just like, I know you meant for this to be serious, like, at least more serious than it is, and to be threatening, but there is kind of, like, a winky funniness to it, where we can see you as the director being like, oh, look how interesting this is, and it's like, then should, like, concentrate more on, like, this being, like, actually horribly scary. But anyway, they all get out of there, and then this leaves the crew of the Betty with Sigourney Weaver and the doctor, Ren, and CSI guy, and so they're like, uh-oh, what do we do? Because we're here. How do we get out of here? And they're like, well, let's go to the Betty, because that's her ship. And they have this dumb plan of how it will take them 4 million years to get to the Betty, apparently, from where they are.
Yeah, because there's only, after the two escape pods, there's only one other way to get off. And they're suddenly so far away from their ship where they got on. It's just a maze. Like, it's a thing that they invented to add drama to the thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And to top it all off, you have Ren, the evil doctor. You have them come across one of the test subjects, who was one of the frozen guys that they abducted.
Oh, right. The nervous guy.
Yeah, nervous guy. And they tell nervous guy, hey, you know, you were abducted and stuff. They come across Sigourney Weaver's clone room. There's a 1 through 7 on the door, and I have a number 8 tattooed on my arm. What could it mean? And
they went through all the trouble of getting the frosted glass guy to come out and do a 1 through 7. Presumably he did like 1 through 6, and then once 7 failed, he had to change it again.
Yeah, I would have personally used a different numeral, because it really reads like I-7. Like, I feel like that is not great for legibility for a military base.
Yeah. It's also just...
why'd you store them all in one room, especially when one of them is still alive? It's weird.
Why do they get a labeled room, too? Like, oh, here's where we keep those dead abominations.
Welcome to the abomination room.
Yeah, where's the restroom, guys? Oh, it's you go down this hall. When you see the abomination room, you go 2 more doors, hang a left, and it's right there.
It's so weird, too, because when she opens it, it's just like, here are these formaldehyde, like... beakers full of dead specimens, and then she rounds the corner and there's the one that's still alive, and it is it's Sigourney Weaver underneath a lot of puppetry, where there is an alien malformed arm and leg and stuff, and an incision on the chest from presumably an unsuccessful attempt to extract a queen from that one, and
who knows? Maybe they did extract a queen from it, and they're just like, let's see if we can keep this one alive.
Well, I'm guessing they didn't extract a queen from that one, because otherwise they'd have more eggs or queens.
Maybe they have two queens. Maybe that's what that other queen was.
That's not what that was.
We don't know.
No, we do know. It was unsuccessful. That's why they did the 8th one.
I guess.
I feel like... While this movie may have some confusing motivational parts and other things, I feel like it's pretty clear on this point that 1 through 7 did not work, and that 8 was the one that worked.
Yeah, but then why did it have a scar?
Because they tried.
Hmm.
Yeah. But she also has a lot of armpit hair, which was... a questionable important point of this, I guess, and the weird camera vantage point of looking at her bare chests and stuff. It's like, what was she kept alive in here for? What was the reason for this? Like, they obviously are comfortable keeping the other ones in formaldehyde tubes. Like, what is she doing there like this? We do, of course, get the scene where number 7 pleads for number 8 to kill her, She says, "Kill me." And this is perhaps the most iconic part of the film, which you may have heard referenced elsewhere in pop culture. And Sigourney Weaver proceeds to kill her by the most horrible, slow, painful, agonizing death she could manage in the scene by setting her on fire. There's nothing instantaneous about being burned alive. I don't understand the decision to do that. And then she burns the whole rest of the place, and then the temperature differential causes the canisters to explode. And then after this deeply important scene, we get horrible Joss Whedon dialogue of, "Oh, why'd she go and waste ammo like that? Must be a chick thing." And it's supposed to be played for laughs to diffuse what was a stressful situation, except that it also undermines and undercuts the seriousness of murdering clones of yourself, because they were part of an experiment in which the person you're based on was basically abused in ways past her death that are just absolutely awful. But instead, you just get a funny yuck-em-up punchline out of it, and it's just like, ugh, that's gross. I don't know why you wrote that. But they move on more down the hall. They go to the water wetworks room thing and stuff.
It's what did he say? It's something about like the coolers, but somebody must have opened the vents or something. So it's like, are you guys swimming through antifreeze? Because that would be really bad.
Yeah, they say coolant tanks or whatever. But
sure.
I mean, you can cool things with water. It's just like they don't say this is water. But they.
I mean, even nowadays, we don't really cool stuff with water that much.
You cool nuclear reactors with water.
Sure. Maybe it's a nuclear reactor.
Yeah, maybe on the spaceship. So they're swimming through, and then there are aliens swimming through, like iguanas, done by Blue Sky before they would go on to do the Academy Award winning short film Bunny and the Ice Age series of movies and Rio. This is
really makes you think that the aliens may have come from a planet with a lot of water on it, because they seem very adept at using their tails to push them along underwater.
Yeah, so much water from their home world. Nothing but water. Tons of water.
That's why they're very their flesh is very like strong and not fleshy, so it doesn't absorb all of the moisture that they're swimming around in all the time.
Yes, and that's also why they have a very thick mucus coating, so that the water does not organisms in the water don't affect them,
so things don't stick to them. Mm-hmm. Basically,
it just lets them glide through the water,
because they're rubber and you're glue or whatever.
Yeah, they just dive right in. They can penetrate right through the surface of the water.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're covered in KY jelly.
Yeah.
But they get through the kitchen. Ron Perlman blows up one of them with a slow moving grenade. The Hunt for Red October style, and then the other one swims around ferociously because of that. And this is supposed to be one of those scenes where it's like, oh no, we've never seen aliens underwater. This is going to be like such a crazy moment. And it's like, oh, well, their black levels don't match the plate, so they're brown and the plate is blue, cyan. So there's stuff. They just keep doing stuff, and they get out from the slow-moving thing, but the girlfriend of Wincott dies too, because he died and the other thing, and she decides to swim sideways with a weird scissor kick thing that she's doing and drops her gun instead of shooting it. But
it was also dramatic the way the alien finally like caught up and grabbed her foot and like dragged her back into the water, but...
Yeah, but they did it all like art house style, where it's like cut to close-up of alien hand on boot, cut to close up of bubbles, cut to close up of, you know.
Yeah, and then like pulled her out of focus, and then the focus stayed where it was, which, yeah. You know. But like, did the alien just like hold her underwater until she drowned, or like kill her or something? Does it really matter, I guess? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, apparently, the pit that they dug in order to film that scene is still on the Fox Studios lot, and they built the Firefly sets over that horrible pit.
I guess you would, if you're using water, you would rather dig a pit than build a vertical thing.
I don't know. Maybe. Yeah. I'm not a foreman.
You're not a water tankologist.
No, I don't build water tanks for alien swimming. But they get out, but there's a membrane over the water, so they're like crashing against it until Sigourney Weaver gets there, and then she uses her fingernails to pull it apart because she has metal fingernails apparently. And then one of the face huggers pops out from the eggs that are all bordering around the thing, and they scream, "It's a trap!" Which is, it seems like the most convoluted way to trap anyone is like, well, first, we're going to flood the mess hall so that anybody who approaches from specifically this angle needs to swim underneath it, and then they'll be caught and die underwater so that the eggs can't get to them. But then if they break it by accident, then they'll get to the eggs, and then the eggs will get them. And it's like, well, there are like 20 steps there where things are not going to go that way, but whatever. I guess that's a plan. I guess it's a trap. So anyway, they scream, "This is a trap," and they get up there, but they're kind of trapped in the water. One of the facehuggers gets on Ripley. She's knocked out, and they're the one that she's relying on. So the Ricochet guy bounces grenades off of the only piece of shiny metal that's in the whole entire ship, which is apparently over the eggs.
It's always shiny because he needs to be able to see the reflection before he can think like, oh yeah, stuff bounces off of things.
Yeah. I mean, it's so artificial looking. It looks like there was a glass box inside of a metal frame up on the ceiling with alien eggs in it, because they needed to make it so clear that it was a reflection of the alien eggs that it's just like, this is preposterous. But he does it in slow motion, and then CG grenade shells fall down and then blow up for 10 million years on the other side, because we just cut to the same explosions going off for forever for two grenades. That blows up all the stuff up there. They get out up onto the surface. They start climbing up the ladder. The one that was in the water jumps up after them, hops onto What's-His-Face and Chrissy, who are latched together. His gun is jammed. Chrissy gets acid on his face from acid spit, because apparently Jean-Pierre Jeunet saw Jurassic Park and was like, hey, the Dilophosaurus can spit tar. So,
oh, there's totally some Jurassic Park camera angles and actions in this one. There's one point where the alien pops up and is running around. We're sort of like tracking with it, Jurassic Park style. Also, in this movie, suddenly the aliens have deep growls, like monsters / dinosaurs. That was new.
The sound design is not my favorite of the alien films. They mixed in a lot of weird animals to try to make these noises, and I don't find it successful.
I guess the quiet, intimidation and scariness of the aliens wasn't appropriate for this movie or something. Like, they need to be loud and like roar and stuff.
Yeah. I don't know what it is about directors where they're just like, turn it on to maximum. It's like, less is more, especially if you're trying to make something scary. Less is more. But they did not do that in this case. And so we got more is more. But they get out of there, and the evil doctor guy says, oh no, I can't do this. You need to give me your gun, to Cole. And she gives him the gun, and then he shoots her. He's like, you're far too trusting. And
oh my God.
She falls in the water. And then
the idea that this guy has some motivation other than survival at this point tells you everything you need to know about the writers and directors of this movie, that they don't understand what this movie is supposed to be about. Because what is he doing? He's gonna backstab them. So
yeah, it's too cartoonish. What? It's too cartoonish.
It makes no sense. Like, there was no benefit to shooting Winona Ryder, because like, the alien will come after you if you're wounded and leave the rest of us alone so we can escape to the thing. Like, no, that doesn't. You're stupid.
No.
Stop.
No. But he does, and he tells Father to lock the door, which he can do by voice, and it will happen.
Father, lock the door. Father, unlock the door, maybe.
What's his face? DeStefano can't unlock it because he doesn't have access to anything.
He doesn't have Winona Ryder's Banaka keychain.
Yeah, so Winona Ryder, we think, is out of the picture. And then, after all this dramatic stuff of what are we going to do, the door opens and there's Winona Ryder, and she saves them. And they all get out of there and they close the door, And they're like, how did you do that? You took one to the chest. You're wearing body armor? And Sigourney Weaver's like, here, let me finger the hole in your chest. It's definitely full of liquid milk, corn syrup stuff. Mm-hmm. Half a Thai iced tea in here.
Didn't even ask before she stuck her hand inside Winona Ryder's torso and goes like, oh, look, you're an alien. Or, sorry, you're a robot.
Yeah. And the other guy's yelling, you know, you're a robot, et cetera.
I mean, at least buy her dinner first, geez.
But she's like, there's this weird, complicated thing where DeStefano is like screaming and jumping up and down in the background, which is not helping with the exposition that needs to be delivered. But apparently she is a second generation of these synthetic androids, where she's an android designed by other androids, which was supposed to be a success, but was a failure, and that's why they don't do androids anymore. And then she says that, and then somebody says, oh, well, you can connect wirelessly to the computer and you can do that. And she says, oh, no, we all burned our modems, which is a very current reference. People always talk about their modems these days. Then the guy says, oh, well, you can still plug in. And the guy says, yes, there's a port in the chapel. Why does he know that there is a port in the chapel?
What are you talking about? There's always a port in the chapel. it's like, you know, you get your toilets.
Yeah.
With the toilet paper there on the wall and the sink over in the corner, and then in the chapel you got a port to connect to the mainframe.
I mean, it's like that old saying, any port in a chapel.
Exactly. It's you use it to plug into your holy rechargeable Bible.
Yeah, she genuflex, and Sigourney Weaver comments on, oh, you're programmed to do that.
Does she genuflect, or does she just do the sign of the cross?
She says silent cross, sorry. She didn't genuflect, but she...
she should have, but she didn't.
I feel like she did a little, like, knee bend. But she...
might have just been her sitting down, but yeah.
She sits down, and she, you know, like, oh, I don't like it. It feels like my insides are liquid, and then she pulls out... a mole, which has a little piece of spaghetti on it, and then she sticks the enormous stereo headphone jack into her arm, and then she starts reciting computer facts about breaches and stuff on the ship, and then she finally gets a grip on what's going on. Ripley has her turn the ship, and, you know, set the self-destruct, and she's like, oh, I can't do that, we don't have enough critical mass because we burned so much fuel getting to Earth so fast. Because the ship had been recalled because of the damage on board.
Right. I was going to ask you about that. So,
seems like a dumb procedure for your medical experiment ships.
There's an emergency failsafe that the ship flies back home to Earth if something goes wrong. That is in another movie, right? Is that one of the Alien movies?
I don't believe there's an emergency failsafe that flies back to Earth. I believe people just fly back to Earth, but
there's totally another movie where something happens and the ship does an emergency failsafe flying back to Earth, and I thought it was also in the Alien universe. Maybe it's Prometheus or the other stupid one or something. I don't know what it is, but I know that exists somewhere.
Okay, but mainly the reason why it was going back to Earth is because Joss Whedon really wanted to get the aliens to Earth and had several drafts of this film written where there's an ending on Earth, more so than there is in the final film, and they tried to hint at that, and what's left here is basically just like, hey, go back to Earth is like their plan, which doesn't make a lot of sense from a logistical standpoint, because it's like, if you have a ship that is like in dire need and like full of damage and stuff, it should go to the nearest other ship or port or station or something. Like,
yeah,
something.
Earth is no longer in the game in the Alien universe. Like, it's a planet. Like, they've colonized other planets. They have docking bays out in space somewhere in different places. Like, there's no need to ever go back to Earth unless you have family there or something. Like, it is no longer like Starfleet headquarters or whatever in the Alien universe.
Yeah, and one of the weird things is, like, they... in the Alien universe, they never really talk about, like, faster-than-light travel. They have, you know, cryo-sleep and stuff so that people can sleep for a long time during travel. But in this film, they are out somewhere far away, and then they come back to Earth real fast. And that's why they've burned so much critical mass of the thing so that they can't blow up. So Winona Ryder says that, and then Sigourney Weaver says, oh, we'll just crash it. And, you know, well, that'll take care of that. And so she reroutes.
Also, it makes it sound like they burn so much fuel that they can't self-destruct. The self-destruct mechanism on most ships is just lighting the fuel tank on fire. I don't think that's how that works, especially in the other Alien movies.
No, like there are charges that actually go off.
There's like a nuclear bomb with keys and stuff and instructions.
Yeah, so it's weird. They just did it so that they would have like some other way to do a ticking time clock thing for this, because they adjusted.
I mean, ticking clock to crash into the Earth is really not that different than ticking clock because the thing is going to blow up.
I suppose, but they would have had the option to say, we're not going to give ourselves enough time to blow to get off. We're just going to blow up this whole thing. They can just blow right past that. Also, you have the motivation of the writer who wants to get the characters to Earth. So there's that.
And we still, oh my God, we've been talking for this long. We still haven't even addressed the newborn alien baby.
No, it hasn't happened yet. So they get out of the chapel, and they go on their merry way, and they're like, okay, so everything's cleared to the thing. Oh, and when they were in the chapel, Winona Ryder has her big scene in the film where she takes control of the door locking mechanisms and says, father's dead, all aliens to deck one, all aliens to deck one. So she has her big revenge on him for that, but it doesn't amount to much of anything because he comes back later. So they're walking to the ship as fast as they can. And Sigourney Weaver's like, oh, they're calling to me. They're calling to me. I hear the things. And it's just like, okay, whatever. Sigourney, let's go. Ripley, let's move it. And Ripley's like, oh, I don't know. Like, I'm just going to stand here on this grate. And all of a sudden the grate gets yanked down. And Sigourney Weaver falls into a blob, a writhing blob of alien stuff. And there's alien tails everywhere. And then there's like, I don't know how to describe it. There is just like this bloated brown black sack that she's on top of and sinks into like an enormous beanbag with a hole in it.
It's a big beanbag chair.
It's so weird. I don't understand. And they're all just standing up there looking at her the entire time because they can still see her from their vantage point. And then they're just like, oh, well, nothing to do. Let's go to the ship.
She fell into the Geiger ball pit or whatever, and yeah. Now she's just sinking.
Oh, the Geiger ball pit. Oh, it's so gross. So then there's a bunch of weird dissolves and fade to blacks and fade ins and stuff to go through this montage of alien orgy that's occurring, which is disgusting on every level. And then you have, I guess, Ripley spent on the ground there, like recovering from whatever that was. And Brad Dourif is suspended from the rafters, mumbling to himself about like, oh, Ripley, you gave her a human reproductive system. You know, there was one cycle of eggs and then there was one cycle where everything changed. And, you know, this is your gift to her. And then the bursting forth from the super gross thing is this absolutely revolting pink gross rumply like been in the water pruned up too long alien like raisin child thing that's just like absolutely revolting to look at not just like in a Geiger this is some grotesque alien thing that I'm looking at. This is just like because it goes so close to like trying to be human flesh, it crosses a line into like a different territory. It's not the uncanny valley or anything like that. Like you could tell it's not a human being. It's just like it's just super disgusting on like a really anatomically similar level to humanity that is far more revolting than looking at the alien xenomorphs that are in the film. I don't know what your reaction to the newborn baby was, but I especially that little like horn thing for a nose. It's just wiggling. Yeah, it's wiggling.
It's like it's based on was it Skeletor with the nose thing?
Yeah,
but then
yeah.
They just kind of like they kind of turned him all into jello and then stretched
it's like
him.
Skeletor's grandmother. It is.
There's an incredibly disturbing image of it on Wikipedia.
Yeah,
but yeah, it's just
supposedly
got, you know,
it was going to be even more anatomical than this, with more human anatomical parts and stuff on it.
It says that they were removed during post-production, which means what? Somebody had to paint out an alien wang or something?
I think it was not the wang.
Okay, sure.
Yeah. So anyway, super gross. You know, Brad Dourif's up in the rafters mumbling, "Beautiful butterfly," and then the baby smacks off the mother's jaw, face, everything, in anger, I guess. Unclear. Some anger management issues. It seems to not understand the world that it's in very well. And then it's like, oh, hey, look, my real mom. And it's looking over at Sigourney Weaver. Sigourney Weaver's like, oh, crap. Which way do I go to get out of here? And she skedaddles as fast as she can.
She's like slowly backing away and against the wall, but she's also fascinated staring at it. And the problem, it's not really a problem. It's just I don't know what to do with this, is that she's like, she feels that sort of motherly bond with it a little bit, not like expressed in any particular way other than maybe a little look of sadness on her face here and also in the finale scene. But it's like, why does she feel bad for this thing? And this is another one of those things where it's like, I don't know why I'm rooting for and or relating to Ripley anymore, because is she, what's going on here? Why do we care about this thing?
She can identify a little with this creature that is of two worlds, basically. Like, it is part human, part xenomorph, because she is now part human, part xenomorph, but she is also more weirded out by this baby than she was by the alien queen or any of the other xenomorphs up to this point. None of those like skeeved her, but her own baby like skeeves her. Like, she's so grossed out by her own child, but is also somehow like, I feel some responsibility for you. But she doesn't have that feeling for the things that she wasn't grossed out by. Like, maybe it's because they look so dissimilar from her, or they were so different from her, and because in a former life she fought things that were like them, and then now she's faced with something that is not like that. However, I would say from an art direction standpoint, they blew it because, just like, what? This is the worst part of the film.
It's pretty bad. Maybe part of it is also, I mean, I get whatever, her partial memories are in place, but like, she's ostensibly like a day and a half old or something, or I don't know, maybe she's a couple of days old, but now she's feeling very motherly and responsible for this thing that was just birthed. It's just all weird.
Yeah, well, Brad Dourif says that like the scar tissue damage has been over 3 days or whatever at the beginning, from the chest scar. So there have been at least 4 or 5 days, basically. She's been around at least bare minimum, but at the same time, yes, I agree. It is strange that she has these feelings and desires and things, but she doesn't seem capable of processing it either, which might be part of the reason why she runs away, in addition to the fact that baby seems homicidal.
It's just, I guess the other thing is, like, all of her motivations are kind of like half-baked. Like, she's not like super terrified to run away. She's grossed out, but she's also kind of like connected and responsible. She's fleeing to the ship to escape death, both from the aliens and from the ship crashing. But she's also not like, like, you know, she regrets that she has to kill the newborn while they're flying away. All of her motivations are just kind of like, well, I guess I got to kind of do that, but I'm not super into doing that. I could do the exact opposite, but I don't know.
Yeah. Well, everything's very, very muddled here at the ending. And she just runs from
it. I got to scroll away, man. This thing is still on my screen, and I just can't keep looking at it.
Stop looking at it. Who told you to look at it this whole entire time?
I don't know. I thought it was useful to have it up in front of me while we're talking about it, but it is not.
No. Be like, oh, yes, that nose horn. Let me just stare at it.
Does it jiggle, too, when it's sniffing her?
Yeah. Well, it's not that it jiggles. It's just that the facial articulation wrinkles up the whole face, which makes the little horn thing ride up over the, I guess, presumably plastic piece underneath that silicone so that it slides around and wiggles. Which is not how horns work, but I don't know, which makes it more like, I don't know, like a weird fingernail horn. It's very strange.
It's a dangly bit of cartilage from a nose that didn't grow because it's Skeletor.
Yes, it's disgusting. And so she runs away from Disgusting Baby. Brad Dourif gets his head crushed by Disgusting Baby. She runs to the ship. They're taking off. And Ren was surprised on board the ship. And then panicked guy is freaking out. And then he maneuvers himself so that his chest burster bursts out of him and through Ren, killing him, which is a maneuver. But also you get the weird camera shot of the CG camera going down the guy's throat to the CG alien head mouth thing in his esophagus before it bursts out. So that's a shot. That's a shot in this film that needed to be there. And then Ren is dead and he is dead and the alien baby is dead. But Ripley jumps on board. They take off, but the hatch is open. And so Cole goes by herself to make sure that the hatch closes so they can leave. And then in there, she's confronted by the newborn who apparently had boarded. And the newborn understands enough about the English language apparently to close the hatch. So she does. And then Cole freaks out and runs inside of, I don't know, a letterpress. And then in the front, Sigourney Weaver remembers all of her piloting skills and says that this ship is older than she is and maneuvers the ship out of there. And there's vibrating and jostling and things are exploding with pressure and like all kinds of stuff. And it's just like, aren't you not in an atmosphere at all right now? And the answer is yes, they're not in an atmosphere at all right now. But somehow in the following scenes, they are moving at, I guess, the velocity of the ship that had been going before they escaped. So they're still going through the Earth's atmosphere anyways, even though they have disconnected from the journey that the ship was on. And what's interesting is you get the ship saying, like, you know, 20 minutes till this thing, and then you get the line of dialogue, 20 seconds to take off before this thing. So 20 is an important number to remember. And as you had said to me earlier, it takes 20 minutes to get anywhere in Los Angeles. But they get off of the ship and after all that rumbling and stuff, and DeStefano goes back there to check on Cole. And it gets his brain crushed out and destroyed by the baby. Sigourney Weaver figures out, oh, hey, people just keep disappearing in the back. Maybe I should go. But she's the pilot, so it seems like maybe not you. Maybe send Ron Perlman. She goes back there, and there's the baby. And so she tries to make nice and make goo-goo baby doll eyes at it and stuff. And then she sees the tiny, tiny window, and she gets an idea, which is that she will cut her hand on her baby's teeth and then fling the blood from her hand exactly on the glass of the space window. And mm-hmm. she does, and that dissolves a little hole, which causes the entire thing to depressurize, which sucks the baby over to the thing, and then the baby is slowly crunched through the hole in a really gruesome and grotesque and overlong sequence that is completely absolutely unnecessary to anything, where the baby is turned into just organic blobs that fall out the other end. And then the ship crashes, and there is an eye distort that wipes over South America, I guess. I don't know.
Oh my God, that Earth crashing ship shot is so bad.
Ridiculously awful. But then they are still in the atmosphere, and then there's that weird helicopter shot where it was like some fisheye lens wide-angle helicopter shot that they put inside the tiny window, but like corner pinned it to the window, so it's like the camera moves through it, but it up until it connects through the hole, it's like a weird tiny TV kind of feeling, because it doesn't match perspective wise. But then they go outside, the camera goes out and looks at stuff, and it's just like, oh wow, look at clouds and stuff. And then Sigourney Weaver and Cole look out of the window, and they're like, oh, so this is Earth and it's pretty and blah blah blah, and I'm a stranger.
We're finally
here too.
Home. Yeah. Which apparently, I'm sure you read that there is a deleted scene that they filmed with the intention of basically making it that they landed on sort of like a bombed out, abandoned Paris.
Yeah, but it was cut because it was like too much like Planet of the Apes or something.
Also, like I feel like that would kind of reinforce what we said earlier, but I guess that's kind of the antithesis of the point of the movie, is like, why would you go back to Earth? There's nothing there. Why would the ship autopilot back there? It's not useful.
No.
But whatever, it did. You know, you got your goopy alien through the airlock, and then it's just over, basically. And it's left me just sort of wondering, like, what was this movie supposed to be? / why?
This movie was supposed to be an entry in a franchise that would continue the franchise.
Yeah.
And I don't feel like it does it in a satisfactory way. I feel like there are interesting things that happen in this film in the course of doing all this awful stuff. And there are cool shots or interesting set pieces or some interesting pieces of set design or lighting or stuff. But then it's all thrown in there with all this other awful stuff, so that it's kind of like, well, I don't recommend it for any particular reason, and I certainly don't recommend it based on this ending. I feel like the entire third act is just like a flaming garbage pile. Like, there is nothing good that happens from the time that Sigourney Weaver is standing on that grate and gets sucked down for the rest of the film. Everything after that is just irredeemably bad, awful, nothing good, absolutely nothing.
Yeah, I agree with that. But on the larger feeling on the whole movie, I just don't feel anything for any of these people or the story, or there's no suspense or terror or anything to it, really. It's just like the parts that are supposed to be scary are recycled from the other movies. Like, there's nothing particularly unique there. And it's just it's a maze in space with some gross aliens, and then it's over.
Yeah.
I don't know. This is not one where I don't get mad at this movie the way I get mad at Prometheus and Alien Covenant for just utterly squandering their opportunities. This is like, what do you do after Alien 3? It's like, well, we want to make another Alien movie, we'll give it a shot, and here's an idea. And they gave it a shot, and it was just like, well, that was boring. But it's not like they're, I mean, I guess they're kind of,
they just killed the franchise, really.
Yeah, but they're not really like ruining anything for the future. Like, in the same way where Fincher took a big move, like at Alien 3, and he killed Ripley. Like, that's a big thing to do to a franchise. This doesn't really do much to the franchise other than bring back a half alien clone of Ripley, which you could very easily just like do away with if necessary later. But, I don't know. It's just, it doesn't do really any much of anything.
Yeah, and that's one of the frustrating things about the ending of this film, is because we're supposed to care about the use of the xenomorphs by these greedy people to do things. Like, that is a point of the first three films, and it is a point in this film. But by the end of this film, we are supposed to care about this Ripley who contains this illicit alien stuff inside of her. So what do we feel or do about that? It's like, that's an unanswered question. Presumably yeah, you could have dealt with that in the fifth one, but it wasn't in the cards because nobody wanted to go see a fifth one after this. This wasn't great.
Yeah. And in the other movies, they turn into a much more dramatic survival tale than this one did. Like they all pivot from like corporate greed to let's just try not to die. But this one didn't really do it in a very useful way.
No. Ripley's not by herself. She is with this crew of miscreants the entire time. And she had a little bit of that in the last film where she had the convicts to work with on this stuff. So she's not it's not so that she's not used to being around people who are not exactly morally upright. But these particular morally unupright people are not interesting. Like I said, Michael Wincott is garbage. Just like his character does nothing. There's nothing there. It is like, I am a bad Han Solo thing. Like I have nothing in me. Ron Perlman, is a space ape. And he has a lot of like gross, misogynistic, awful lines. It's a space jock ape thing.
He's a cartoon. Very much a cartoon.
Yeah, and Dominic Pignon, you know, he's he doesn't do anything really in the course of the film. Like he has actions he performs, but he has no real internal life. He stares at Cole from underneath the machinery at the beginning of the film, and he cares.
He's in a slightly different type of peril because he's in a wheelchair.
Yeah, like he's got a like heart of gold, but he's like not. There's nothing to him, like substance wise, in the story writing. And then there's Chrissy, who just has arm guns. That's his characteristic, and that he can shoot ricochet stuff. That's it. And then you have DeStefano, who is security guy who freaks out and stomps on grates. There's nothing. There's no like real meaty characters there for Weaver to interact with, except for Winona Ryder's character, Call. So that's it. That's all you got.
Yeah.
Anna Lee Call.
Mm-hmm.
The first few times I saw this, I thought it was Cole, but spelled Call. Don't know why.
Because, you use your modem to call people.
They call you on my modem phone.
Oh God, no!
No, this is not an auspicious entry in the Alien franchise, in my opinion. But
it's very forgettable.
I'm going to tell you something that is going to like make you so mad. Do you know what that is?
Is this your favorite Alien movie?
No. It's not going to make you that mad. this is... I rank this over Alien 3.
I'm not sure that makes me mad. Well, okay, so what's your criteria?
My criteria are I can deal with the first and second act of this and that it is not abnormal for a third act to be bad. So I am more willing to overlook that in this than I am willing to overlook the first, second, and third acts being bad in Alien 3.
This is certainly a more cohesive attempt at a story than Alien 3 was. They tried to do some stuff. They had some ideas. They were just not good ideas. Alien 3 is just like, let's shoot a bunch of scenes and see if we can make a movie out of it. Aesthetically, I find this movie very displeasing, and obviously Alien 3, well, the setting wasn't great for it, but the way it's shot and the suspense of it is better, and Ripley is more of a Ripley in that movie, but they both have pros and cons. I'm not sure. I feel like I could give Alien Resurrection a slight edge over Alien 3 just based on the fact that it is a movie instead of just like a hodgepodge of stuff. Even though Alien 3 looked cooler, it's just it's not a thing. There's nothing there.
Yeah, and I would also argue that in the ways that it looked cool, were weird. Like it had weird Victorian hospital vibe thing going on in some parts of it and stuff. Like it didn't feel like it sat in the pre-existing world of Alien or Aliens.
Yeah, but like in terms of like the way you shoot a scene to add drama and horror to things, like Alien 3 did that miles better than this movie.
Well, like I like the scene where Charles Dance is talking to Ripley in the hospital and the alien drops down behind Charles Dance and does all
that
stuff.
That's what I was thinking of.
Yeah. And like, that's all good. And the good thing is it's not diffused by Fincher with anything weird and goofy. There is no CG hand grenade that gets thrown at the end of the scene.
Yeah. I feel like if Alien Resurrection, if you could like remove all of the extreme wide-angle close-ups in people's faces or just, like, stupid Dutch angles of close-ups of dumb crap and shoot everything from a reasonable 15 feet away from the actors, this would be a much more competent and watchable movie. Even with the stupid, dumb third act, like, you would still want to do something about that, obviously, but just, like, take all of that weird, like, cheekiness out of it and just be a little bit more conservative with the way it's shot, and it would feel much more like an actual alien horror movie.
One thing I thought that was interesting, though, is that the score by John Frizzell seems to reference at some points the scores from the previous Alien movie. There's the when they're doing like the intro thing that I made fun of for being ridiculous in that it doesn't make any sense where the camera is. There is some of the music cue kind of that you hear when the cryotubes are being opened. And I feel like Frizzell's score overall, while not being memorable, fits with what was happening. Whereas I feel that Alien 3's score by, what's his face? He's escaping me right now, but his score is not, it doesn't fit with, either Goldsmith's or with Horner's, that came before it. It is another case where Alien 3 for me, is a little demoted just by virtue of the fact that it doesn't seem to sit well with the rest of them. Now, the alien design, alien stuff, was all done by Alec Gillis and all the other people who did the stuff for Alien 3. So you have a continuation of the people who worked on the alien stuff from one movie to the next. And the alien queen puppet is actually the same alien queen puppet that was made for Aliens. James Cameron had given it to a collector, and the collector had it in his garage, and they took it, and then they spruced it up, and then put it in this film. And they're like, thank God he still had that thing, because it would have been a nightmare to recreate that.
Mm.
Yeah.
Going back to the score briefly, I don't actually remember the score of Alien 3, but while I was watching this movie, it did remind me of something else that I actually can't even place right now, so I shouldn't have brought it up, but I was listening to it and I was like, yeah, this sounds like a very different movie than what I'm watching right now.
I thought it had like the
maybe
creaky,
it was just one of the particular
thing.
Scenes that it was just reminiscent of some other 90s
was it,
movie.
Was it Office Space? Was it King of the Hill? Was it I Still Know What You Did Last Summer? Was it Dante's Peak? Was it 13 Ghosts? Was it Ghost Ship? Was it Gods in General?
Are these other movies done by the same guy?
Yes. These are all done by John Frizzell.
King of the Hill, you say?
Yes, King of the Hill.
Hmm.
Texas Chainsaw 3D.
Oh, God, no.
Leatherface.
Not a fan.
Legion, Shelter.
Hmm.
The Lodger. From Mexico with Love.
Damn it, Bobby.
Anywho.
Well,
I'm not I'm not giving this thing an award. And also I will say that while I ranked this over 3, the gulf between that ranking and Alien and Aliens is enormous. Like enormous, enormous. Could not believe it. Could not make it back there and still have critical mass to explode. This the distance that is that separates those from those two movies. Like, I feel like Alien 3 and Alien 4 have more in common than Alien and Aliens.
Oh yeah, definitely.
And especially in terms of execution and flaws, primarily being the motivation of the studio executives to muck with everything, causing all kinds of problems on every level of production and pre-production. So that really separates the first two from the second two. And then you get into the whole shebang of Aliens versus Predator, and you get into the awfulness of Prometheus and Alien Covenant, and you just have like a big old mess of things that are even worse than these two, which is hard to believe.
You know, I think if one thing unifies this entire franchise, it is odd and not always great casting. Like, I feel like the casting in Alien was probably the best, and when you get to Aliens, like, the cast is great, but they're all very James Cameron. And if you kind of like try and say like, well, why does this work in the Alien universe, it is a bit odd to try and say like these people fit this universe that we established in the first movie. And then Alien 3, the casting is ridiculous. This movie, the casting is absurd. And then once you get into the Prometheus and the Covenants, the casting is just like, well, literally, what are you doing?
Yeah.
And of course, I have no thoughts yet on the Aliens versus Predators, because I think I saw part of the first one.
Oh, I've seen the whole first one. I saw it in theaters. It's been many, many years. And
but do you get that vibe, though, that like kind of casting throughout all of them is
spotty and
weird, but slash not ideal? Yeah. Like, literally every one of them, even Cameron's Aliens, I feel like the casting is odd.
But while it's odd, I like it.
It's good and it's iconic, but like, you go like, Bill Paxton, really? Like, is that the character that represents what you would think for an Alien sequel?
No, but the character as written was this jokey Marine guy who didn't really believe in the threat, and that all of his faux machismo evaporates. So in that case, yes, Bill Paxton suits that role. And Michael Biehn fits perfectly for Hicks, because he's just a cardboard cutout, you know, good guy. That's what he does. So he's fine for that. Like, you know, he travels back in time to save John Connor. He can do this. And you get the good casting of the, Corporal, what's his face? The guy who chewing the scars and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel
Paul Reiser's great.
Paul Reiser's very good. And speaking of people who are traditionally known for comedy, like he does a really good job of being this awful, slimy corporate business guy. And, you know, he's I think around this time it's contemporaneous with him being in Beverly Hills Cop. Like, he's not known for being this slimy corporate business guy. So he does a good job. In contrast to, you know, someone like Dan Hedaya in this, who is not a believable military general on board this ship. Who seems incredibly incompetent and not really in control of what's happening on board. So you have like different levels of this. So I don't completely agree that James Cameron casting is bad. I would say that James Cameron's casting is he uses a lot more people that at that time had not been sourced for those sorts of roles, I would say.
Yeah, it feels like, I mean, I'm sure it's all totally in retrospect now, but it feels very James Cameron.
Yes. Yeah. Well, he was just getting his career started then, so it's very easy to say that it feels James Cameron now. But what did he have? Terminator under his belt? And then that was it. So you can't say it feels very James Cameron. I mean, the carryovers from Terminator are Michael Biehn and, blah, I'm blanking on Bishop's actor's name and it's driving me crazy.
That guy.
Lance Hendrickson. So he's the only real carryover from Terminator. So it's not that it's not that it fuels James Cameron at the time that that had been made, because there wasn't much else going on. It fuels James Cameron now because he would work on with those people later on in his career, like what's her name, Espinosa or whatever, the tough lady. She is John Connor's foster mom in Terminator 2, as we had discussed. So, like, he worked with these people through his career over and over and over again, but this was at the start of his career, so it was before he kept doing that. Yeah. Jean-Pierre Jeunet is just like, give me Dominique Pignon as much as possible, so. And Ron Perlman.
Oh, boy.
But
this is a longer conversation than this movie deserves.
It's so much longer. I think it might be longer than the film. But lastly, I would say that Joss Whedon has distanced himself from this and said that they didn't do it the way I would have done it. But at the same time, he wrote it anyway. And there are a lot of bad lines of dialogue in here, like, who do I have to bleep to get off this boat, etc. and stuff. And it's just a lot of horrible one-liners inserted into grossly inappropriate situations that deflate the importance of what's supposed to be happening, which is a Joss Whedon trope, but is one that is not suited for the Alien franchise, and it sticks out like a sore thumb when you're watching it.
Yeah, but so, his lines are so catchy and quippy and memorable that, you know, they'll make you want to come back for more.
They didn't, because there was never a fifth one. This is the last one with Sigourney Weaver.
Yep.
Yep. The end.
Bad movie.
This is a bad movie, a good bad movie, or a movie you
people,
kind of had your DNA bonded with.
People in the Defocus Slack said it's a good bad movie because it's, you know, not trying to be more than it is. And, well, I agree that it's probably not trying to be a whole lot more than it is. I don't know that this is a good bad movie.
I'll put it this way. I've seen this maybe 3 times in my life. It is not a good enough, bad enough movie for me to watch more than that. I may never see this again, but it was included in my Alien Quadrilogy set that I got off of iTunes when I bought this 4 years ago when we started out on this crazy trip.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
92 all the way to 97 for the gap here. That's fair distance between the two movies.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy. Are we done?
We're done.
We're done. It's hot in here.
It's getting hot in here. So, blah, blah, blah.